We're live. Good morning. It is time to get started. Welcome back for week two of our study of Romans. Last week we went through background information. This week we're going to dig into the actual text. Before we do that, Brother Sean will lead us in prayer. Thank you. A little bit of review from last week. The book of Romans was written at Corinth in AD 57-58. It was written to encourage the church at Rome, to all of the saints at Rome, where we find there were both Jews and Gentiles, or Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. And we didn't actually discuss this, but perhaps there was a majority of Gentile Christians at that time, because in AD 49, I believe, the Emperor Claudius had expelled all the Jews, which included all the Jewish Christians. But then he died in, I believe it was 54, and so they were coming back in. Now, whether they had all returned to Rome by that time, we don't know, but there was probably a good mix of the two. In the book of Romans, we find Paul outlines basic Christianity first in theological terms, and then he gets into the very practical terms or practical applications. That starts really at about chapter 12. And he laid out his thesis, or what we consider to be his thesis for his text, in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith." So we contrast the righteousness of God to the righteousness of men. That which is revealed in the gospel shows us God's righteousness, that is, his plan for making us righteous with him. If we look at man's version of righteousness, could someone get Isaiah 64 or 6? So man's righteousness before God is like filthy rags. The things we want to do. Now, you look at all of men's religions, it's all something about, well, if I do this, if I can be this well enough, then I'll be acceptable to God. And as we're going to see very clearly through our study here, that's not the way it works. Actually, it boils down to God saying, admit it, you're messed up. You know, you're in a sinful condition, and there's not really anything you can do about it, but if you trust me, I take care of it. Trust me. So Romans has good news and bad news. Which one do you want first? Most people say bad news. Well, this wasn't really a choice. Paul just laid it on them with the bad news. So today's section, Romans 1:18 to 3:20, is the bad news. It's we're in this condition. and we're all in this condition. Remember the line that was popular a few years ago, I'm okay, you're okay? Well, sorry. His news is, we're not okay. So first he turned to the Gentiles in this section of the text. And the Gentiles had no law. So could they know God? He argues that they could have. To what extent, though? What could they, without God's direct revelation, they could know things about God, but knowing him the way that we can through his word was just not possible. But what could they know about God? Robert. Certainly his glory in creation. We'll take a minute to look at that, Bill. Okay, so you had the patriarchs. Mm-hmm. The text says his invisible attributes. Things, as was said, you can look at nature, you can look at the creation, and know something about the Creator. His power. Right? What kind of power would it take to actually create all this? What kind of intelligence? His nature, some things we can learn, not everything certainly. How could they know? Well, here we're going to have a little show. Just a few pictures. By the way, anybody know what that is? That is the flower of a wild strawberry. It's about this big. This one may be more familiar. Everybody knows this one. I don't know what this is. I saw it in Romania and took a picture, but I don't know what it is. This is another little one. It's a wild violet. But what do you see through all of these things? Order? I like this one. You know what this one is? Pardon? No, nothing so noble. It's okra. That's an okra blossom. They come out, they last for about 6 hours and they fall off. But what do you see in all this? You see incredible beauty, design, interesting. The biologists would tell you, oh, well, this had to evolve to attract the bees. Do bees really care how beautiful a flower is? I mean, color, and if it's got something to eat. They're attracted by color, scent, and taste. But why this incredible display of variety and beauty? Well, that's just one thing. Now, here's something internal to us, and this may be a first for a prop to be used here, the eyeball. The human eye has these different muscles. There are six different muscles that work this thing. These that are highlighted, the superior and inferior, turn the eye like this, vertically. The next ones, the medial and lateral, turn it sideways. So you've got up and down, side to side. But then there are two others on there, which are the superior oblique and the inferior oblique, and they turn it like this. I don't know if you ever noticed that your eyeball actually does turn this way. Sometimes maybe you wake up or you just open your eyes and your eyes aren't in focus and you'll see two images that are a little out of register, but then your brain fixes it, turns your eyes so that the images line up. Well, what's really interesting about this thing is this little thing up here, the trochlea, which that arrow is pointing to, right in here. This is a little loop of cartilage that's in there right next to the nose, or right on the side of that septum. And the tendon from the superior oblique goes through this thing and turns a 90-degree angle. Where in evolution would DNA have decided, oh, there's not enough room here to put this muscle to have this action in that direction, so let's get clever about it, put in a little pulley, and change the direction? I would love to hear the evolutionary biologist's thing for that. They just answer all this with, DNA did it. You watch their debates, DNA did it. Really? Clever little molecules. I mean, as an engineer, I look at this thing and I say, that is elegant design. And to say that this just sort of happened at some point, personally, I find ridiculous. So, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. And the text goes on. Essentially, they set up their own gods. We don't want the real God. We want something else, whether it's us, our own knowledge, or some idol, some image. We look for explanations, and sometimes, rather than just admitting we don't know, we make up stories, which is where all of mythology comes from. Getting behind my notes here. So they had their futile speculations. Why do they not acknowledge God? Why would somebody not acknowledge the obvious? So if they acknowledge that there actually is someone else, someone besides them, that would say, I need to do something about that. They have to admit, there's somebody greater than I am. And that's the last thing most of us want to admit. Somebody else is really in charge. Somebody else has a much greater power than I do. So what kind of futile speculations do we hear today? To use that phrasing. Yes. Bart? Aliens. Oh, it's aliens. Of course, that begs the question of where did the aliens come from? It just pushes it one down the line. Others? What do people say instead of, I recognize God? Horoscopes? Find your answers in the stars. This is really, you know, people make arguments against God. And you've probably heard dozens of them. Or at least there are six or eight of them that are very common. Things like, how could a loving God condemn his own creation to eternal punishment? How could a loving God condemn you to eternal punishment for a temporary sin? We're only here for a little while. And is anything in there so bad that it deserves eternal punishment? This is kind of a trying to reason around it. I like to flip that one over, though. We're only here for a little while. Is that short bit of obedience worth eternal life? Ken? Good point. You hear the ones like, oh, there are many paths to God. All religions are going in the same direction. It's just different ways to get there. Look a little closer. They're not going anywhere near the same place. Of course, one of the big ones is, how could a loving God allow pain and suffering? That is a big, it's a deep question for many, but they just say, well, couldn't be. Basically, it comes down to setting up something that they don't like and then just rejecting God entirely because I don't like that. Well, I don't like paying taxes, but, you know, that's the situation I'm in. So there's the matter of facing reality. Where are we? What is our condition? And admitting to our sinful condition is part of it. So God's response to this, the text goes through repeats three times he gave them over. First in 124 and 25, it says he gave them over to impurity. Would someone read that? And then somebody else be ready with 26 and 27 and 28 through 32. So there's the first rejection of God, and so he tries, and they say, no, we don't want this. He gives them over to impurity. This is just kind of the beginning stage. Then the second one, 126 to 27. So this one goes another step, not just immorality, but to perversion. And then we have the third step, 128 through 32, where everything goes. Who has that? in studying for this and reading over this, I thought, this sounds an awful lot like what has happened in this country since World War II. There, not that everything was perfectly moral prior to that time, but the social decay that has happened, just kind of, well, if it feels good, do it. You know, that's your thing. I can respect that. Those sorts of phrases, for those of us that are old enough to remember the 60s. And then it snowballed, and you had, you know, overturning of sodomy laws and things like that. Well, what's done in the privacy of people's homes is their business, and everybody says, oh, okay, we'll take that step. But then it comes out farther and farther, and it becomes a public display. And if you look at television and movies and such, immorality, adultery, all kinds of these things are just portrayed as normal, expected. And this is what our children are being raised in. And it's going to be tough. You know, we've got some real work to do to fight against this. Any comments in there? It is nothing new, and certainly you could say that this progression could happen on an individual basis or on a society basis. The point about those who celebrate, you know, you talk about the tolerance. Tolerance is a good thing. We are not supposed to be judging people for what they do. We're supposed to be helping them come to salvation. But these words get twisted. You know, we talk about, oh, be tolerant, that means approve. You know, in the doublespeak of our society, that means approve this, condone it, support it. And that's what we can't do. Robert. before we leave this point, just a reminder, you know, 1 Corinthians 6:11, such were some of you. You know, when we look at others and say, oh, bad, bad, we can, most of us can remember that I was there too. Such were some of you, but you were washed, but you were sanctified, but you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and in the Spirit of God. Do you have something, Sean? So, time is going to run short here today. We've got a lot to go. Paul's laid out a pretty grim view of the condition of the Gentiles. And you can just imagine, as this letter is being read, the Jewish faction is over there going, yeah, yep, yep, let them have it. But then he turns to the Jews, who have the law, and they're judging others by it, but they don't keep it themselves. And by that, they condemn themselves. So we can go through a kind of quick comparison here between the ungodly Gentiles and the unrighteous Jews. There was no excuse for ungodliness for the Gentiles because they had this evidence. There was enough to say, there's something more that you should be looking for. The Jews had no excuse for their unrighteousness. They had the law. The Gentiles were self-deceived in idolatry. The Jews were self-deceived in their impudence. This kind of, we're special and God's going to take care of us no matter what we do. The Gentiles ignore God's glory. The Jews ignored his kindness. The Gentiles, he said, they had impure hearts. The Jews had unrepentant hearts. And it's the same thing for both. All were to be judged unfavorably unless they obeyed the gospel. So he's kind of put the Jews in their place, and we'll get some more of that. But we're all in the same place. And this is what he drives at so hard here, is that all have fallen, all need the same thing. Now, you don't want to know how long it took me to get this. Paul made a very beautiful and compact statement of judgment here in Romans 2:7-11. To those who by perseverance in doing good seek for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life. But to those who are selfishly ambitious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, wrath and indignation. There will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first and also of the Greek. But glory and honor and peace to everyone who does good, to the Jew first and also the Greek. For there is no partiality with God. If somebody wants to know what the judgment's going to be, there you have a nutshell. But an important point here, as I was reading in the commentary, some people look at this and say, oh, that's saying salvation by works, because you're going to be judged by what you do. But this is not talking about salvation. This is not a basis of salvation. This is, well, let's say two people get hired by the same company. They may both enjoy this, some of the same benefits, you know, health and that kind of thing, benefits, but they do different jobs and they get different recompense. I mean, they get different salaries. They're paid differently according to what they actually do. I don't know if that made sense or helped. But this is not about becoming part of God's family, it's the standing in judgment on that day. We have the situation again that follows immediately after this. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. So you have the Gentiles, those who had not heard, who did not have the law, will be judged accordingly. And those who had the law will be judged accordingly. Did they obey it? Do we obey it? Do we do what we know we're supposed to do? So then you have, I don't know, this is perhaps kind of a substitute question, but the Jews are then saying, so what's the point? Is circumcision an advantage? Circumcision was the seal of the covenant. So, did it matter? Paul says, yes, if you keep the law. But if you break the law, no, it's worthless. And he's beginning in here, this driving this issue over and over again, that it's not what's outside that matters. It's not the externality of religion by itself. It's the heart. So who is a Jew in God's eyes? And this must have started to come as a real shock to the Jews there. You know, they had been raised in this thing of, oh, we're special. And then he says, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. So he's pushing, driving it, this thing that it's inward. All the outside stuff, Jesus called the Pharisees whitewashed tombs. They did all the stuff that looked good, but inside there was nothing. So what advantage? They come back to this question, what advantage has the Jew? What benefit is circumcision? Paul answers, great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. You want a head start? Have somebody give you the book of rules, the directions for how to live, as opposed to try to figure it out on your own. They had a tremendous advantage. When he says, first of all, that sounds like he's starting a list. But as you read on, there's nothing there. Well, actually, in chapter 9, verses 4 and 5, there's the rest of the list. But he begins with this. The problem was that they were not doing what the law said, and so they were reflecting badly on God. And there are a number of quotes in there to the effect that you're making me look bad, in essence. My name is reviled among the Gentiles because of your bad behavior. So another question. So they weren't doing what they were supposed to do. They were not being good representatives. Does the unbelief of some nullify the faithfulness of God? And here we have the first time that this expression here, that's Greek, it's Greek to me too. In the New American Standard, it's translated, may it never be. In New King James, it's certainly not. I believe in King James, it's God forbid or heaven forbid. In others, they say God forbid. English does not have an expression with that strength of negativity that this Greek term has. And anybody speak Greek, want to do this one? I used Google Translate and listened to it about 15 times to try to get this. In modern Greek, it's something like miyeneto. And it's miyeneto. It's absolutely not. How could you possibly think such a thing? Whatever man does has no effect whatsoever on the faithfulness of God. He made his promises. He's going to keep his promises no matter what we do, whether we listen or not. But they come up, but. And there's this argument, I paraphrase this. If our being sinners was necessary to give this contrast to God's righteousness, to help explain and show how his truth and his way, well, he kind of dumped us into this. Isn't that unfair of him to judge us for being what we are? Isn't God wrong? Can't I blame him for it? Does this sound like something else that you've heard somewhere? Or where God might have said, don't blame me. Yeah, all the way back to Eden. This woman whom you gave me. One that I thought of is in Job 40. God's response to this, 40 verse 8, where he begins to speak out of the whirlwind. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? You know, I've got to be right. I got to weasel out of this somehow. And making the judge wrong is going to be, you know, if he's wrong, then he can't say I'm wrong. But it is not unfair. God makes the rules, and by his wisdom and his will, he has put us in this, we are in the situation that we are in. He's given us a way out. It may not be what everybody likes, because it means actually acknowledging him, but he has given us a way out. Following right behind this, there's sort of an argument. Paul says, some people essentially say to us, have said of us, that we say, oh, go ahead and sin, because where you've got this sin, it just shows God's righteousness and his truth all the more. And he says, their condemnation is just. I don't know if it's right to say that there's an expression of disgust in there, but he doesn't really give that argument any real honor. Just kind of, their condemnation is just. Don't deal with it. Then the question, what then? Are we better than they? And the translation is a little uncertain here. You know, we've got two sides of the discussion going on. Are we better than they? One says, are we, meaning the Jews, better than the Gentiles? And a footnote in the New American Standard says, are we worse than they are? So in this comparison, one way or the other, it gives you the same result. It's not that we're worse, it's not that they're better. We're all in the same boat. He's really bringing this home that we're all in the same boat. Doesn't matter what your heritage was, we all have this problem with sin. Not at all, for we've already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. And then he concludes this section. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. And when we get into some later chapters, he's going to go a lot into how the law brought knowledge of sin. Before the law came, sin was not imputed, because where there was no law, there was no sin. Well, in the strict sense. But we have the law. We know better. They knew better. Now, we have a couple of minutes here, so next week is the youth rally, so we'll have whoever's speaking then. So we have a break from Romans. You get 2 weeks until I come back. You can all breathe. But now, this kind of raises a corollary question. Is there any advantage to being a Jew? All those questions. Is the name Christian an advantage? We could ask ourselves that same kind of question. I call myself a Christian. Does that give me an advantage of some sort? Certainly, well, you made a point there of the self-monitoring. That if you bear that name and you are watching what you do to live up to that name, certainly it is an advantage. But there are so many things that we could do. Robert. Yes, just having pasted on that name at one point doesn't mean much. Floyd? The reason I put this up here is just as a point of reflection that we don't do like what the Jews did and said, oh, I'm in, I'm special, and relax. We've got to keep living according to this. Did you have... Yeah. It's not what you call yourself, it's what you do. Seems like the bell is late, but I'll take advantage of that. It rang? Oh, rats. Okay. Thank you for your kind attention. We'll be back in 2 weeks.